Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Welcome to the last episode of 2022, featuring one of everybody's favorite guests, I've been told many times, Michael Lipson, who appeared back on episode 139. He's a meditation teacher and therapist and author, and his new book, Be an Alphabet of Astonishment, has just come out. It's a deep and lovely series of contemplative vignettes on gratitude and being human. I wanted to just talk about part of what this podcast means to me in the beginning here, and the dance of gratitude and anxiety. Whenever I do this podcast, I'm reaching out to strangers. So I don't know if you've thought about that as a listener. I actually didn't really think about it until recently when I was thinking, isn't this weird a little bit? I reach out to strangers very often. This is just a cold call. I like someone's work and efforts and who they are in the world, and so I send them an email. When you hear me talking with someone, most of the time you're hearing our first conversation ever. I am, of course, familiar with what they've done. I try to read everything a guest has written or listen to their music, see their movies, read interviews with them, listen to their podcasts, and so on. So I have been walking with them in a way beforehand. But the meeting is a meeting with a stranger. It's new. And that meeting comes from the overcoming of anxiety and the focusing on gratitude, the focusing on how grateful I am for what they do and who they are in the world with us. There's the intent to openly meet another person, another human being, that overtakes the anxiety. This podcast is a record of strangers meeting, and you walk with us in that way too. You're hearing two strangers speak, and you yourself then get to walk with us to create a sense of warmth in that strange meeting. And I hope that that enlivens you and strengthens you to meet others in conversation as well, or maybe just meet yourself in conversation. But there is something special about really meeting the other, and not just having the conversation be your own thoughts conversing. The meeting of the stranger reveals to me then the rewards of anxiety. Let's remember that the world itself is a stranger, and so there's anxiety there. The world is strange. Our experiences are strange. And also, the world is estranged. It can seem distant from us because we've become locked in habitual everyday patterns that make the world around us seem distant. On the other hand, every day, the world is also asking to be met. It's waiting. You don't have to do a cold call ever, really, with the world. It's just waiting to be seen and attended to. So, anxiety can come from deciding to meet the strange or the stranger, but it's also a doorway for us into gratitude and meeting. Michael writes about this in the chapter in his book for the letter F. So each chapter has a letter. It's an alphabet. And F is for fear. And we speak about this on the show.
When we have fear, that means we're starting to open. You can absolutely be afraid of a piece of gravel, not neurotically or insanely, but because it's starting to come alive for you and you realize it's an element of the living sacredness of the universe, to say nothing of a human being. And when we even, our social anxiety, for instance, is just some kind of very dim beginning appreciation of the enormity of the other person or the group.
In other words, what if anxiety is a call to just see the world for what it is, to meet it? To see the world as a mosaic and tapestry of spiritual beingness and beings, including us. To look into it seriously is to converse with the stranger. I'm reminded here of a line from Joyce's Ulysses, which, if you know me, is one of my favorite books. Any object intensely regarded may be a gate of access to the incorruptible aeon of the gods. when we meet the world, we should offer it the light of our own hearts, rather than hoping it will shed light upon us, because that's what a real meeting is. To meet is to give, to be solar and sun-like. To merely try to command the world with magic or other technologies, or to force ourselves into confrontation with it, with, say, hallucinogenic drugs or deceptive vivisectionist science, that can just really be extractive. Not to say these things are universally bad, I've certainly entered into some of those mysteries myself, but what if we now need to go beyond demands to be met ourselves, or just demands, and go into and towards real meetings? To that effect, you have a quote here, then: to be solar is to shine whether or not someone else is shining on you. When you're talking about giving, it's solar. The moon is getting light before it decides to give it to anyone else. And so, you know, the astral kingdom, the kingdom of magic, the kingdom of the hallucinogenic drug beings that we encounter, is a lunar kingdom. We travel a certain distance, but it's not far enough to break the orbit of the material version of ourselves. It still continues to be tethered to us in a certain way. But the solar kingdom, you know, if you go out that far, you start to, yeah, you retain but dissolve yourself, as you were saying before. It takes the earth away from us, but it keeps us in the source that's giving to the earth. And that's something very different. So this pursuit of the solar, where we get close to the givingness rather than sort of orbiting the earthbound self with what we are calling our spiritual gestures or moves, is so important.
So we don't need to get the solar from outside. That would still be lunar on our part. But we actually become radiant sources. And by going through a human life, this time on Earth really is important in itself. Not only a place to learn or work out karma or things like that, but it is something in itself. It is already a radiant spiritual deed now.
See, anxiety leads us to want to get something, that lunar anxiety. It's a call to us that is not yet complete in what it is trying to say. Look, it says. Look at what's happening in the world and in your life. And perhaps in the mysterious future and the mysteries of the spirit and the mystery of meeting the other. Look. And just know something might happen to you if you go there. So you better make sure you're prepared to get out of it something good that you want. But see, to complete this call, we must also give. Because if we want to really see what is in the world, to see a real picture, we must look with our hearts and love when we look into the picture, because that is where the truth will lie. So looking onto the world with love is, in some ways, just another way of saying gratitude. Gratitude is that one radiant way of seeing. So, hello. I'm grateful to you and greeting you with love. Thank you for being a part of this. Against Everyone with Connor Habib is brought to you exclusively by patrons on Patreon. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib. The show exists because of the love and care of listeners who appreciate the show. If you love the show and have not yet contributed, please do today at whatever level feels right. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib. If you do contribute there, I want you to know how much I appreciate it. I love making this show, and I love having these conversations, and I'm excited that I get to do it more next year because of you. And to all of you, really, thank you. I'm very, very grateful to be here with you. Here's the last episode of 2022. I'll meet you again in the new year.
Hi, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Welcome back, Michael Lipson. Hello.
Thank you. It's great to be back. Hello to you.
Hi. Well, so I want to talk about some of these letters in your book, B, An Alphabet of Astonishment. The one I want to start with maybe is a little funny. It's F, which you have down as fear. And the reason why is I was thinking about the process of making this show and how every time I do an episode of the show, aside from when I ask people back on like yourself, I have to meet somebody. And the fear in your F there is a lot of it is about just the fear of really meeting the other. And so, you know, I'm generally meeting a stranger. I'm coming with hopefully an offering, not armed with questions, but an offering of questions and, you know, things that might seem like sort of riddles for us to get into each other. And then the recording preserves the meeting so we can encounter the meeting again. But I don't think people really, I didn't even really consider it actually when you think about podcasts and all this, that you're meeting strangers. And so you're also meeting me, you know, we met before, but that was the first. F is for first, the first meeting that we had with each other. But you also do it as a therapist. You meet a stranger and you sit with them. And so I'm going to talk about that meeting first and the fear of it. And the fact that sometimes the fear doesn't come up at all. Sometimes we come up with tactics or strategies to overcome the fear. And sometimes we just can't overcome it. But let's talk about that meeting first.
Well, sure. I guess the basis for a meeting, as for a whole epistemology or how we know the world, including other people, is to realize that everything is actually unbearably sacred. That the world, the other person, but also a piece of gravel or a landscape, everything is unbearably sacred. When I say unbearably, I mean we can't handle it in our normal, everyday, Western, Northern, educated, you know, consciousness. We dumb down the world continually, but I mean every nanosecond. Not because we're trying to, not because we realize we're doing it, we just in fact do it. That's why Blake said, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would be seen as it is, infinite. Mm. The infinite depth within, let's say, because that's the example you brought up, another human being. The infinite depth within another human being is something that's too great for us to integrate or perceive with normal consciousness. And that's why we need our spiritual trainings, not to get closed down or rigid around a dogma, but to get open and willing to perceive more of everything that comes towards us. Because everything is too much for this normal consciousness to bear. So the fear, mostly we don't have the fear we should have. When we have fear, that means we're starting to open. You can absolutely be afraid of a piece of gravel. Not neurotically or insanely, but because it's starting to come alive for you and you realize it's an element of the living sacredness of the universe, to say nothing of a human being. And when we even, our social anxiety, for instance, is just some kind of very dim beginning appreciation of the enormity of the other person or the group. So unfortunately, we're not afraid most of the time because we're so successful at dumbing everything down to its normal everyday status, where we go, oh, I already know that. Well, it's no big deal. It's just a piece of gravel. Or it's no big deal. It's just my old friend, you know, or it's no big deal. It's a guy I despise, let's say. Or there's some category, of course, then we know it's prejudices, you know, some category of person that we look down on or feel as other or unimportant. Unfortunately, that's what we do all the time. When we have social anxiety, it's the beginning dawning of the fear that itself is a kind of early manifestation of our opening to the enormity of the other being. Mm-hmm. So that's why in the Bible, and I think I give this example in that chapter, divinities, let's say angels, When they appear to a human, it always says, fear not, because the humans are afraid, like the in the Gospel of Luke, you know, the shepherds are sore afraid in the King James translation, when they see the heavenly host and hear it. And then the divinity says, fear not, like, it's good that you are afraid in the sense that you're opening to this is an enormous thing coming towards you, but now we're giving you a little passport, kind of temporary dispensation. You can come closer to us. You can be with us more deeply beyond fear. So that's not because you've closed down or you've gotten very, you know, brave and strong. It's because you've dropped the fear that was the sense of losing your normal self. You're actually opening into the other person and not holding so tight to your sense of self and other, who you are, what the other person is, as I say, dumbing them down.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Well, there's so many doors that have been opened here by everything you said. So I think
go into all of them.
Yeah. Let's see what happens. You know, one of them, the first one that I was thinking of when you were speaking was how your H, I, and J in this book, Hallelujah, Intensity, and Joy, you know, they form this little trinity of, I think, what, you know, the psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan would refer to as jouissance, where there's this overwhelming enjoyment or this overwhelming intensity of being that you want to cry out, but if you can move into it, you can almost experience it as joy. And I was thinking about how this book overall is a book of gratitude. I expected G to be for gratitude, but it wasn't. It's a book of sort of gratitude, a book of seeing and experiencing. And then in that sense, it's the gratitude is sort of a I don't like the word strategy, but it's a way of navigating the unbearable, the jouissance, that overwhelming enjoyment of existence. And every time you give gratitude into something, or you present a noticing or a thankfulness towards something, even fear, the fear of meeting, like you have a story of the anxiety of meeting somebody that you were excited to meet, right? I think that we can, you know, do something with that unbearableness. So that's one thing. But then you took it into the sort of fear of meeting the spiritual world, which I find really interesting, that there's so much fear of encountering the spiritual beings, you know, angels that you bring up here, or the sort of spiritual transformation of our own being during death, which you do write about quite a bit in this book. Why is it the case that, would you say it's the case that the spiritual beings become, they're terrifying to us or terrifying to so many people before you meet them because they're unfamiliar, and then they sort of hold that in common with the ways, as you're saying, that we make the everyday world familiar, but the everyday world itself is not really familiar to us. Like it's constantly, could be constantly new and shocking. And in that sense, then it is that that's where we can see the spiritual in the everyday. I don't know if I'm characterizing that in the way that you would say it, but what do you think?
I think the essential thing, the reason we have fear, we do need to be someone. This is where I'm perhaps different from some misunderstandings of Buddhism. I don't think our good development is to utterly disappear, like dissolve into the light or dissolve into the ocean of the absolute or God. But we are meant to do this rather delicate balancing act, or impossible feat, actually, which is to be someone even though we dissolve utterly. To still be someone even though you aren't holding to any boundaries. And normally we are holding to our identities. Psychologist, American, you know, white. I mean, my God, we've got so many identities. heterosexual, you know, we have identities, and holding them more loosely is a very important part of adult development. And everybody really knows that already. But we want to hold this identity more and more loosely and actually give it up entirely and yet not disappear, not just merge into the all or into the spiritual being or into the physical world, into a grove of trees, let's say a sacred grove. But we want to find a way to subsist and persist as a someone, as I am, even though we aren't holding to any existing characteristics. Fear comes up as that process. It's one of the sort of phenomena that arises in that process as we actually livingly go through it. Now, from the start to the finish of his life, Steiner kept mentioning strength, that we need to get strong. But what he meant by strong, if you look at it, it's not all tough and strong and certain and the right ideas and so on. He meant the strength of the attention, the strength of the love, the strength of the ability intentionally to immerse in a topic. But that intentionality is the person. So if I intend to dissolve into something, I'm becoming very much myself, even though I've dropped everything. Not a physical form anymore. I have lost my language, everything. And yet my intentionality to go into a realm of meaning, like the meaning that is the other person, that's what keeps me as someone, even though I've utterly dissolved. We do an exercise at the end, I mean, of many of my groups when I lead a workshop, which I just did a couple of weeks ago, where it actually has an origin in the Sufi world. And the Sufis do a lot with eye contact. And what we do is you put your left hand on your heart, with your right hand you hold the other person's right hand. And you sort of turn around very slowly, looking in the eye of the other person, straight in their eyes. No smile, no facial expression. And you don't look away, and no words, of course. And as you turn slowly around, you're trying to do a very simple thing, which is be completely open to whatever might be there, and to hide nothing in yourself. That's your directive. And that brings people to their point of fear of encounter, and beyond. And you notice that you fall into roles with the different people. Then when you're done with one person, having gone around once, you go to another person in the room, and you keep going just randomly, finding whoever's free to go around with you. And you'll notice that some people you kind of want to seduce, some people are trying to seduce you. You know, some people you don't like, you push them away. But if you hold to the prime directive, I'm willing to see anything, and I'm willing to be seen, I'm not holding or hiding. What happens is you come into depths of what is the other person, the eyes being the window of the soul. You don't disappear as an understander, as a knower. In fact, you find you can understand and feel and taste depths to the other person that normally are inaccessible to us, because our normal social shtick is constantly distracting us and solidifying our existing roles. So it's just one way, in a very focused way, especially with a group that's gone through something. You know, it's at the end of a process of group meditation and exploration and sharing. It's one way, one sort of a Sufi-born technology for coming to fear and beyond fear in the encounter with the person. So all these things that you mentioned, H with its hallelujah, and I with its intensity and talking about how to endure intensities, and J with its joy, these are all parts of aspects of, as you're saying, gratitude's another one, aspects of our strengthening so that we can subsist as someone while encountering and even playing with more and more of the depths of existence. Because the depths, as I say, within a piece of gravel are just infinite. And we want to not only sort of enjoy that or perceive that, but be in the world as that with them. Out of that, we would have a creative, truly creative life.
what you're describing then is a way to sort of either contract and expand or reincarnate the outer world, let it die and come back into existence, let yourself die and come back into existence. I love that. It's a kind of breathing with certain types of existence and integrity and coherence. And I think, you know, when you write about in the fear chapter, when we meet people and we don't think we'll ever see them again, you have this line about, you know, meeting people. And so I'll quote it here. It's, you know, someone will say, you know, everyone lied about the loss of connection. They just lied. People would say, see you soon and don't be a stranger. And I'll look you up if I get to San Francisco. Never did anyone say the obvious truth. It's been great to know you here at this job. We almost certainly won't see or hear from one another again, ever. This is the end of our relationship. Goodbye. And I mean, I love that. But then also, of course, we do love the feeling of don't be a stranger, of I'll look you up if I ever get to San Francisco. I'll see you soon. If we didn't receive that longing, perhaps best expressed in I'll remember you and I hope I'll meet you again one day, you know, would be a sort of more accurate way to say it, to where someone expresses the longing of having, you know, met you and wanting to meet you again, we would miss it. But then also I'm thinking of the fact that now these relationships, you know, in this incarnation, in this sort of physical corporal way, they don't have to end because of the way that we can stay connected to each other much more easily. You just sort of look somebody up. You don't necessarily have to say goodbye to someone. And I don't know if that, if that interrupts the possibility of a kind of ending and longing that might've been available to us before. I don't get to long for you because I can have you again if I need to. And I don't get to really end this because I know you can find me again. And that, you know, as opposed to, I'm thinking of this really beautiful novel by Dennis Johnson called Train Dreams. It's only about 90 pages. It's one of the best novels ever written, I think. But it takes place in a sort of burgeoning, you know, industrial America. But, you know, it's this guy who has a job. His house burns down. He, you know, he's doing some logging thing or whatever, and he has to, you know, move to another town. And he doesn't know that he'll ever see those people again. He doesn't know that he'll ever contact them again. You get this sense of a kind of life where, and then he moves to another job and he loses some members of his family. And you just get this sense of a life that is much more like these encounters of, the goodbye and the longing and the keeping someone with you in the longing or that turn of phrase rather than keeping them with you in their actual availability.
Absolutely. I would say that it is too bad that we don't have a chance to feel the painful loss, because in that pain of loss is a kind of a teasing and a toning of our emotional life, where it could open to the way in which, in fact, we don't lose anyone, not because of the internet, but because in some way we really are eternally one with everyone we encounter, even very briefly. So, and every now and then we know that is directly through spiritual perception, through unusual perceptions. So, the longing, like the fear, is a kind of emotional limit case. It's a threshold phenomenon where the longing and the sorrow at loss is just before we, if we could push it a little further, just before we actually perceive that we don't lose them. We lose them physically, sure. And when someone dies, we lose them physically forever. And the grief and the longing and the loss there is totally appropriate, of course. It's almost a precondition, heartbreak, for going a little further at times in the direct experience of the continued relationship. Mm. But that's not superstition or belief system or sentimentality. It's that can be a perception. So whether it's someone who's alive and you're not going to see them again physically, or someone who's dead and you're not going to see them again physically, or a spiritual being who was with you and is gone, the longing and the loss, as I say, is not just to be taken as the last thing, but a moment in a potential process.
Yeah, I was going to say that in some ways it's a training for the death of others, but actually now I'm thinking it's more of a training for our own death in a way to experience that, because I'm thinking of how, you know, Rudolf Steiner said, like, you know, death is the most meaningful event that can happen to us, you know, and now I'm thinking of John O'Donohue, the Irish priest and Hegel philosopher, saying, you know, like, you lose all the conditions, you lose all the conditions at once. So the rush of meaning comes from the loss of the conditions that you once knew. It's like there's a falling away and a falling into, you know, this new state of being. And that is like, oh, I've lost the person entirely. You know, I met them once. It was a beautiful encounter. I've lost them entirely now into the world without them, where, you know, I only contain, you know, the inner experience. And I think that that makes me wonder about the the ways in which the inability to lose track of others, or the ultimate constant availability of others, makes it harder for us to contend with death. Yeah.
I think so. I think it's a simulacrum that is actually blinding us to some fundamentals of existence. And the ways in which life is preparing us for after death or various other conditions, it can be dumbed down, or not dumbed down, what am I saying? Diluted. Really prevented by the internet. That's why it's so important to do things like what you're doing, which is to see, can you enrich the internet? Can you make it a challenging place? Can you make it something that isn't a substitute for, but a goad towards deeper encounter with life?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm glad that you think I'm doing that. It's nice to hear. I think I'm also thinking about, you know, when we talk about the fear of meeting, I'm thinking about the ways in which we fear meeting ourselves. So death is one way in which we fear meeting ourselves, because obviously that's a deep aspect of who we are, you know, carrying our death around inside us, as Steiner would say, or as Adam Phillips might say, like, our death is our project, you know, it's our only project in some ways. And but I think then another way is, you know, when you have, so the V chapter is for vital or vitality, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you start that by saying, in therapy, I'll often ask, when do you feel most alive? You know, you'll ask a client or a patient, when do you feel most alive? And you're surprised to find that, you know, or maybe not. So maybe we weren't surprised, but we are surprised as readers to find, you know, okay, so the socialist who talks about making luxury furniture, I think a lot of people resonate with this, that when we feel most alive actually seems at odds with who we think we should be. And in that way represents a place where we're afraid to meet ourselves. And how do we then meet ourselves and allow ourselves to meet ourselves without merely having that sort of radical break that, in a lot of ways, just that radical break between I'm an absolute socialist, but I really like making these nice things that, you know, actually are objects of class war if I want to look at them just from a socialist lens. That radical break signifies an unhealthy, you know, aspect in a way, that sort of huge chasm between those things where you can only really occupy one or the other. So how do we meet ourselves to create health in these instances without just discarding the vitality or simply giving up the idea of who we should be or that sense of potential?
Well, I think we kind of get beyond the paradox there if we realize that, well, let's say one way of saying who you really are, what and who you really are, is a will, an intention. Another way of putting that is a desire. You mentioned a project. There's something that drew you into the world to take incarnation. It isn't necessarily something that we have words for that's very delineable, like, I had to be CEO of Coke. But it's something like, as I say, it's too big for human words, but some great desire brought you into this world and you may have developed new ones through your time here. And coming in line with the going further in the direction of your desires is your health, is your having your real life, not a substitute life or a delay or a life that was imposed on you somehow and you've forgotten. So finding our little desires is part of finding our total or big desire or the will or intentionality that we really are. So just the reverse of saying, you should deny your desires and figure out what's right and good. I'm always interested in people finding, well, what puts the spring in your step, as that person said who made the luxury furniture, or what do you really want? When do you feel alive? That's putting you in touch with something that's very important. Let me give you an example of how this comes up often and is sort of plays people false in the kind of therapy speak that we all live in now, which is people like to talk about their needs or distinguish their needs from their wants. And they say, I need this, I need you to be here, or I need this and that. To me, that's not a good way. It's not a healthy way to talk. It actually makes you weaker, even if you're stamping your foot and insisting on what you need. You're much stronger and you come more into your integrity as a person if you say, I want this. I want you. Not I need you. Not I need whatever it is, more free time or more money or whatever it is, more travel. You're much stronger if you say, you know what? This is what I want. Of course, you might have to negotiate with someone, but this is what I want. And that puts you in line with yourself deciding. And that strength, it's not that you can always get what you want, but you can try sometimes. It puts you in line with your gradually with your total intentionality, because beyond wanting, a new watch or something, a bigger house or whatever people want, beyond that, I want, well, what do I want? And I find it by going in the direction of my desires, not by stifling my desires in the name of some should, some duty.
Yeah, that's really well said. I think when I think of need in that sense, it becomes a materialistic proposition. I can't live without you. It becomes like these sorts of statements that are really declarative about just even the condition of being alive itself. Like they become ultimatums for arranging what happens in the world around us rather than an expression of who we are. And I think that then it's like
the other person free. It doesn't leave the other person free.
No, and certainly not you, right?
Can't live if living is without you is actually a power play, which isn't
exactly. And it's, whereas desire at least has the chance, or want has the chance to have a moral quality to it, but a need never does. I mean, either it's a sort of law of the cosmos, which a need, most people in their stage of spiritual development need to eat, they need a certain amount of breath and heartbeat, but those are just sort of physical laws. Whereas the, what we want, those are, those do have a moral contour to them. And I was thinking about desire then, because when you were talking again before about the spiritual world and the do not and the be not afraid or do not fear, so many people I think have trouble coming up with what they want to do with their lives or their desires or their sort of long-term desires or goals or whatever, because of this exact thing. They think it needs to be expressed in terms of need. So when I meet people who are afraid to say what they want or afraid to express what they want, usually it'll be tangled up in some practical thing. Like I'll say, well, what do you want to do with your life? And they'll say, well, you know, I'd like to just make a little bit more money. And I'm always like, really? That's it? Like, I mean, that's fine for some people, but also like, it's not a real expression of desire. It's just sort of like entangled in the material world. Whereas our desires are, you know, they're contact points with the spiritual world in a way. So if we can sort of notice that, I mean, I'm not saying that it's ethical for everybody to pursue making, you know, $5 billion a year or something like that, because that's their desire. But a lot of times when people say that, that's also not their desire. That's also entangled in something. But the desires are, you know, contact points with the spiritual world, and therefore frightening to people in lots of ways.
Find your own desire is frightening in that sense, because you are an element of the spirit. Let me give you another story, though, from the book. I don't know if you remember, but I was, I had been in a workshop with Spangler, David Spangler, and I had the idea from him that whatever you meet, if you start to meet some creature, being, you want to first welcome it and honor what's good in it. Like we say, namaste, meaning I greet the divine within you. Obviously, what's not divine, I'm not that interested in greeting.
And just to be clear for people that are listening and not familiar with David, he's talking about fairy beings and spiritual beings and elemental beings. I mean, I know he could also be talking about animals and plants, but I think in this context, that's probably what he means.
He means spiritual beings, nature beings, but also angelic orders or other kinds of creatures that we don't have such easy words for, but non-physical entities of various kinds. And so I had a dream, and in the dream, I was leaving my house, and a strange figure came into the house, tall, as sort of a stick figure, but with a head like a TV, like a blank TV screen. And it was frighteningly blank. And I thought, I feel an evil energy coming in here. So in the dream, this is all happening in the dream, but somehow in the dream, I remembered, greet everything with welcome, greet everything openly, be willing to honor whatever is good in it. So in the dream, I, without words, I sort of inclined myself in a welcoming way towards this weird stick figure with this TV, blank TV head. And I just sort of was willing to be open to whatever might be promising or good or mutual in it. And the arms and legs retracted into the TV kind of thing. I mean, it was just a box. And the box then flew around and attached to my back. And as the door to my house opened, this box sprouted wings, and I flew out and up into the day, praising the light and praising the day. And it was such an experience of joy. So it started with fear, where I'm anxiously protecting the boundaries of, you know, the world, like I know the world or who I am and who it is, what's what and what I should be up to, and I'm off to work. And this threatening, challenging thing comes. I feel maybe there's evil coming off it. But then it went through this magical transformation. So for me, that's a kind of stayed as a model. I wouldn't say I know what kind of entity that was. Was it a real encounter? Was it merely imaginal, quote unquote, merely? I don't care really about characterizing that encounter or that dream, but I do care about the lesson that I got from it, which is simply what I knew beforehand, but it was like a viscerally important demonstration, inclined towards what might be promising, what might be of the nature of a mutual benefit, or might be of the nature of the real world, might be of the nature of the goodness of the ultimate world, in whatever you encounter, human, non-human, waking, dreaming, now, post-death, who cares? It's a good attitude to meet, and who knows what will come. I know I have the freedom to push something away if it really is going to distress me or make me feel dreadful, but I don't want to rush to that in the anxious protection of my boundaries.
Mm. Yeah, you're reminding me of your G chapter, which is not gratitude, but giving. And I'm thinking about the idea of a kind of giving to without knowing that you're going to get anything back at all, or what you're going to get back if you do get something back, and how that quality is more and more, I almost said needed, but more and more wanted and desired from the spiritual world, that the human activity of giving is such an important stance right now, because so much of what's happening is a need to know before I give, need to understand what I'm going to get back, what I'm going to get out of it, who you are before I give anything to you. And so, you know, to that effect, you have a quote here, then, to be solar is to shine whether or not someone else is shining on you. You make yourself a source. You take responsibility for starting the communication or bringing the mood up. It's not about fairness. Don't wait for the other person. You start the good times. And this was a,
sounds good. I like it when you
read. Yeah, it sounds good. So, I mean, this was a particularly moving articulation for me, because on the past few episodes of the show, or the past like month and a half or so, I've been really investigating like how we should be careful in the coming years of the temptation to use magic and to do hallucinogenic drugs, to do some of the things which I've done in my life. So this isn't a condemnation of people that are exploring these things exactly, and certainly not a condemnation of people whose true karma or destiny is to engage with all of this. But just because this, there's not the same kind of giving quality to them that there are in other forms of spiritual development and deepening. So it was moving to me just to go on with this a little bit, because you framed it as this is a solar, when you're talking about giving, it's solar. The moon is getting light before it decides to give it to anyone else. And so, you know, the astral kingdom, the kingdom of magic, the kingdom of the hallucinogenic drug beings that we encounter, is a lunar kingdom. We travel a certain distance, but it's not far enough to break the orbit of the material version of ourselves. It still continues to be tethered to us in a certain way. But the solar kingdom, you know, if you go out that far, you start to, yeah, you retain but dissolve yourself, as you were saying before. It takes the earth away from us, but it keeps us in the source that's giving to the earth. And that's something very different. So this pursuit of the solar, where we get close to the givingness rather than sort of orbiting the earthbound self with what we are calling our spiritual gestures or moves, is so important.
Well, we don't actually have to go after the solar, we become solar.
Ah, yeah, right.
We are sun. So it's very interesting to me that the same fella, Jesus, who says, I am the light of the world, says, you are the light of the world.
Right.
So to the other humans. So we aren't just, we don't need to get the solar from outside, that would still be lunar on our part, but we actually become radiant sources. And we, by going through a human life, this is one of the things I wanted to emphasize in the book, well, as in my other books, and it's very much in line with, well, with Steiner for sure, but also with things like Findhorn Garden, but all the great religions in their, and spiritual movements in their origins, including shamanism and Wicca and everything, is that this time on Earth really is important in itself. Not only a place to learn or work out karma or things like that, but it is something in itself. It is already a radiant spiritual deed now. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I'm here to learn in this veil of suffering and then later I'll take those lessons and something. But here and now, each of us is giving or radiating, or solar in that sense, a source of light that is unique to this incarnation. It's not about your eternal individuality that unfortunately gets dirty in this life and then gets cleaned up after death or something. But in this life, you, with all your troubles and the terms and conditions of your life, are potentially anyway, a gift, a radiance, an expressive radiance that is doesn't exist beforehand, won't exist after. It's not about something that comes later. It's the final performance of this moment and this life, and it is a spiritual deed now.
Yeah, I can see that as a sort of picture of, you know, the light coming to refract in different ways through our own individualities. And as you say, with you end the book with A, which is meaning like A life, the letter A life. I'm thinking the love of this incarnation specifically itself, not just thinking about all the other configurations, but the kind of the gathering of you know, the congregation of being that come together for my individuality to sort of come through and refract. And what's the Goethe thing about colors are the deeds of light, I think, is it? Yes. So the way that my being gives a kind of color of light to the world is really lovely. And that's a different kind of loss to deal with then when that incarnation goes away. Right. Like, I think, and it's something, you know, you write really beautifully about your son and then his Asher and his death. But I think that this is the mourning that we come to is not necessarily a mourning of eternal total loss. We can understand that and we can get into that, but the mourning of the loss of that congregation that came to honor that individuality coming to earth. Oh, that congregation is gone. That gathering is gone. I miss that gathering, you know?
Absolutely. And so I'm very suspicious of any spiritual path or dogma or something that would try and make you think you'll be reunited with your lost loved one as they were. You do lose, and it is a good idea to mourn and to grieve and have trouble, at least for a while. You do lose how they were on earth. I met a wonderful mystical person in her 80s in Switzerland years ago, Joa Belendas. And she was in constant touch with all kinds of spiritual realms. And her son died when he was 21, I think, in a car crash. And he appeared to her in spirit form, you know, right after, and said to her, "It's okay, Mom, don't grieve. I'm fine. I'm in touch with, you know, Jesus and the angels or whatever, and everything's blissfully wonderful." And she perceived all this directly, you know, waking and with him. And she said, "But I was just angry. I don't care. I know you're fine. I want you here where I can feed you soup."
Yeah. That's the washing of the feet, right? That's the washing of the feet. That's Christ is, you know, yes, this cosmic being that's come, but also as the person who washes the feet, there's an aspect that's deeply present in this form, you know? Yeah.
And that is lost, and it's okay to mourn that. There are other kinds of encounter that more than reconcile you to the loss. Wordsworth said, you know, "For such loss, I would believe abundant recompense." So there are other things that can make you blissfully happy in terms of your encounter with that being after they died. But it's good to go through the mourning, because that's a deep acknowledgement of how special and unique this human life is. And as you said, that constellation and congregation of elements is not going to happen again.
Yeah. And that's the way I try to describe that you know, when somebody dies, they were concentrated into a certain form of being. And when they die, they disperse. And part of that dispersion comes through them translating their sort of unique physical address into an address that's shared by everybody who knew them, a distributed address. And that process of the distribution is mourning. I mean, that is what grief is. It's the feeling of that transformation. And so if you're not in a lot of ways, it's like we recognize that that person is meeting us in a new way. That's what grief looks like. And I think, you know, but it's interesting because I think now when people die, people are very close to me have died in my life. And I usually don't break down anymore. Or, I mean, of course it's different for everybody. So someone could die tomorrow and I might do a different podcast, you know, but it's happened enough times now that I feel very connected to them, you know, and a lot of that has been through the work with anthroposophy and spiritual development and staying connected with the dead. But, but interestingly, I have a harder time dealing with the mourning around certain relationships ending in the way that, you know, we're talking about before with being a waiter at a restaurant, never seeing the waiter again. When I think about, for example, I have an ex-boyfriend that I never want to be with him again. I don't have any desire to be with him again as a boyfriend. But when I think that will never be again, ever, like that doesn't get to recur, that breaks my heart. And again, it's not a longing to be with him again. It's just an acknowledgement of the ending of it. Whereas I think with someone's life changing into, you know, the life between death and their next incarnation, I still feel a kind of like deep loving communication that's happening. So somehow it's like life is life is such a place of grief and mourning in a way that death isn't. And I don't know if that's just because it's, well, no, I'm about to diminish my own experience. No, it's just an interesting. Yeah.
It all depends, as you say, individual relationships and circumstances, but behind all of them is loss, or you could say the Buddhist word is change, you know, anicca, non-abiding. And, the reason I call the book B is because I am interested in people's having an intensified experience of the reality of, well, this world and whatever else they encounter, and of themselves. And if that sense of the real gets strong enough, we get in touch with that which isn't lost. But that being in touch with what isn't lost in yourself or in the other person, that makes you strong enough to have the sense of loss for what is lost. So if I can really know myself as existent and really know the other person in their eternal reality, then I will not have to push away the grief when it comes for what is lost, what's unrepeatable, but I can fully feel it and it doesn't destroy me. And I'm not afraid of having the intensity of feeling, and I can move on to the next adventure in life.
Yeah.
So that intensity, everybody knows that the world is, or that you are, or the other person is, but to experience these things more and more, with more and more sense of the real, that's what it's about. Steiner referred to that as the development beyond consciousness, soul of spirit self, life spirit, and spirit man. It's actually referred to pretty directly in the Bible in the sense of the importunate friend, the parable of the importunate or persistent friend. It appears in the 11th chapter of Luke, only one place. And it's a friend who asks for three loaves of another friend, to serve someone else. And those loaves or breads are the bread of life or the I am. And he wants three of them. Spirit self, life spirit, and spirit man. But that's sort of secreted there inside the gospel. He asks for these three loaves for the sake of others. So as we exist more intensely, and the Buddhists are very good on this, we also exist more compassionately. Mm-hmm. We're not doing all this stuff just because, I don't know, I want to develop or I want to feel bigger or deeper, better. I want to be radiant. It sounds good. We're not just doing it for ourselves. Of course, we get stuff from it. But we're also doing it out of love. So although I call the thing B, of course, I think that in its essence, the reality of the world is an enormous act of love that we not only notice or echo or transmit, but we ourselves become.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you talk about that loss, that's that the understanding that allows you to sort of cradle or create a hearth for loss or sense of grief, mourning. I was thinking about Simone Weil, who is your W, but I was thinking about something that's she wrote about, which I've experienced, which is called what she calls affliction. And the affliction is a kind of loss that, I mean, I was experiencing it as just a complete severing of connection with the spiritual world or my spiritual self, with God, with anything. And it was horrible. It went on for, I don't know, a month or a few months. And I felt like a robot. I mean, there was no sense of life. There was no sense of anything other than the day sort of passing. It wasn't depression. And people would think that I'm talking about depression, but as someone who's had depression, has serious depression for a lot of his life, this was not depression. It was a completely different thing. Could not really think of things in spiritual terms anymore because I wasn't honestly experiencing them. It was really terrible. And, you know, when she, God can never be perfectly present to us here below on account of our flesh, but he can be almost perfectly absent from us in extreme affliction, is something that she wrote. The extremity of the affliction was the withdrawal of any sense of spirit. And that kind of loss, where the hearth that you've created or the cradle that you've created for other senses of loss and presence to live, is a completely different sort of loss. So it's not as if you've never believed in God and then somehow, you know, so that's fine. It's having created this sort of love and this relationship with the spiritual world and having it go away. And for me, it was really interesting because there was still a part here where there was a reality or a kind of resonance that I knew was somehow still connecting me. It was purely intellectual. I couldn't connect to the feeling of it or the action, but it was one took the form of, well, you would still never really hurt someone, or you would not really try to go out and harm somebody. But there was another that when I read Simone Weil's essay, I thought, oh, okay, there it is. Because I encountered that essay during the midst of it, because I was just looking for help for anywhere. I was like, what is this that I'm going through? And I found this essay and I thought, well, intellectually now I can connect to something. I can't feel it, but there's something going on there.
The connection is never completely lost.
Right.
It might be lost for this psyche, but people who, let's say, do commit suicide, in my view, they do not, their totality as a being has never lost its connectedness, but the psyche this confection in the through and with the brain and the senses and this whole setup of a human life that can be so severely separated. But thank goodness, even in its sort of very attenuated form, it stayed for you, even just in this intellectual or verbal form, enough so that somehow you could climb back there. Now, Simone Weil herself recited to herself this poem by George Herbert, maybe you know, from the 17th century, George Herbert, an English priest. And in the poem, the soul is sort of pushing away love over and over, and love keeps approaching. Mm-hmm. And finally, the soul is willing to accept the love. And she would recite this to herself, as she said, with perfect attention. And then at a certain point, it became the reality. It wasn't just about, but it was happening to her. But in order for her to get there, she had to go through the door of, for her, not that it's necessary for everyone, of affliction and feeling completely abandoned and like nothing good could happen to her. No spiritual opening could ever happen for her. Still, she had this desire, which I quote in the book, from childhood. And I think the momentum of that desire helped her through these miraculous losses and findings. And it's actually the quotation with which I end the book. So maybe I'll read that now. "It is given to very few spirits," says Simone Weil, "it is given to very few spirits to discover that things and beings exist. Since childhood, I have desired nothing other than to have received the full revelation of this before dying. It seems to me that you, too, are engaged in this discovery." So when we discover that things and beings exist, which we already know, so what discovery does she mean? She means opening to how they exist and how much they exist in a way that just isn't there for normal consciousness. For us to appreciate how things and beings exist as what they exist requires already a consciousness that is rooted outside of this existence, outside of this sphere of Earth, and appreciates what the Earth is just because it isn't only of the Earth. We are of the Earth, but we're not only of the Earth. And that's one of the things that you discover in the, as your sense of how real things are intensifies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because we touched on this a little bit the last time we talked, but you've added all these new, it's recurred here, and you've added all this newness to it, right? And that actually is the process. It's the other becoming real and new in a way, but still present. It's also interesting that you keep mentioning Deleuze in this book, whose idea of difference and repetition is very similar to Rudolf Steiner's, although Deleuze claimed to have been the first to discover, which is funny, of course. But
he claimed he was a materialist, but a materialist like that doesn't need any spirit.
Exactly. So he, you know, the idea of every time I meet you, I add to you, you know, so therefore, difference is based on repetition, you know, and there's an interplay. That's obviously a very simplistic way of saying it, but so I think, as you said, there's an opening to the extent that I continue to open to new aspects of your being, that's a commitment or a sort of devotion to allowing the other to really exist. Because, you know, as much as we might say on a sort of everyday level, well, sure, yeah, other people exist and stuff exists and the birds and outside and my house and my bank account, you know, that's one level. And then there's another level, which is like, okay, yes, we're all energy, or, you know, however you want to say we're all together. But the real trick is understanding that we're absolutely separate from each other. But we can only understand that separately. And that's really weird. That is a sort of Christian lesson, that you look upon Christ and you say, he's suffering, he is not me, but in my imagination of him, my imagination, my understanding, or striving to understand the suffering of the other, the separateness of the other, I meet him in a way. And I think that that's really lovely, that we all meet in a kind of separation, as for surface, you say, but separation as well. And I thought also, as for sex, I mean, very funny that, you know, when we have sex with people, we pretend that they're inside of us, or with their, you know, or we are inside of them. But in fact, as you say, in this surface chapter, there's no real inside to materiality. You're just, you know, sex is an attempt to be within someone or have someone in you. But it's just usefully metaphorical. The moment we use our senses to perceive that we're within, we're only experiencing what we're outside of, what is separate, what is distinct from us. So sex is a way of being alone together. It's a way of noticing a separation that we both occupy, and therefore we're together in it.
Well, yes, I talk about surface. I'm glad you brought that up, because there's this notion in a lot of spiritual directions that there are infinite depths and mysteries, but the whole point of all the spiritual teachings is to have everything become evident and open to you. Not that there's, that you'll one day know everything, because there's more stuff always being created through your deeds. So there's no knowing everything in a final way, or being with everything in a final way, because things are burgeoning and life is continuing to live. But the idea that there's some kind of radical stop is also false, that there's a limit beyond which we can't know what is real, who is God, you know, we'll never know. People say we'll never know about this, that, and the other, whether it's what will happen after death or what happened before our birth. And that kind of putting an intentional stop to things, because there are depths that are inaccessibly deep for us, that's just what all the religious traditions and non-traditions have worked to belie, to say, no, no, everything is going to become surface in the sense that everything is available to you, not currently, but potentially, or it's actually open to you, but you're not open to it. So everything becomes surface in that sense, or that's how it tends. When really everyone who's seriously thought about depths turns them into surfaces, like Freud, who completely disbelieved, or thought he did, in all spiritual worlds. But he said, you know, where it is, I am to become, or where the id is, the ego should be, where it is, the I should be, meaning what's now other and separate and hidden, like the unconscious or subconscious, is to become conscious. So those depths are all there to be opened to. And apocalypse in Greek is, that's just an anglicization of a Greek word that means uncovering.
Right. And of course, we describe and characterize the unconscious. So I mean, it's, you know, and what's the Oscar Wilde quote, which is, there's only shallow, what is it? It's only shallow people who do not judge by appearances. The true mystery of the world is visible, not the invisible, right? So I think also he probably thought he was, I think, well, I don't know what period of this life, of his life this was, because maybe it could have happened after sort of Christianization of being in prison. But, you know, he might have thought he was sort of flipping the bird to religious people when he said this, but of course it is a truly spiritual statement as well. Yeah.
And if you've ever read, by the way, Oscar Wilde's wonderful essay, The Soul of Man Under Socialism, if you read that, you'll just go, oh, this was some kind of bodhisattva. This was not he put himself forward as, like you say, as if intentionally superficial, as if that were bad also, or as if that mm-hmm. were silly. But, and he was a fop and a pretender for sure. But if you read The Soul of Man Under Socialism, you'll get a different feeling about Oscar Wilde. He wasn't just, deep feeling and also clever and very funny commentator on social mores. He was a deeply spiritual fellow.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Michael, I think you had a poem that you wanted to share with us.
Yes, I did. It's by A.E. Hausman, English, actually classics professor at Oxford from the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. And it came to mind earlier because of something you said, Connor, about this congregation of events and personages that allows for human life and allows us to give our gift in the specific context of this life that's soon coming to an end. Soon in geological terms, even if we live to be 130. So here it is. From far, from light and morning, and yon 12-winded sky, the stuff of life to knit me blew hither. Here am I. Now for a breath I tarry, nor yet disperse apart. Take my hand, quick, and tell me, what have you in your heart? Speak, friend, and I will answer. How shall I help you? Say. Ere to the wind's 12 quarters, I take my endless way.
All right. Well, thank you, A.E. Hausman. And thank you so much, Michael Lipson.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me. It's great to talk with you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye now.